Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, independent scholar and author Eve Kahn talks about her latest book, Queen of Bohemia, Predicts Own Death, Gilded Age journalist Zoe Anderson Norris. It was published by Fordham University Press this month, and during BIO's annual conference in June of this year, I asked Eve Kahn how she discovered and decided to write about Zoe Anderson Norris.
So in the fall of 2018, I visited a friend of mine named Steve Lomazzo, and he's the world's great expert on American periodicals. He signs his emails Periodically Yours. I'm a member of the Grolier Club in New York, which is a shrine to the printed word and image. It's a clubhouse library museum. Steve's a member. Steve was gearing up in 2018 for his exhibition there about the history of the American magazine going back to the 1730s. We go to visit him, and in his crowded New Jersey home, in the windowless basement room full of 19th, 20th century periodicals, he pulls out a bound volume of six issues of a magazine from the 1910s called The East Side. And I open it up, and it's published by a woman who put her own name in huge letters and showed her image again and again in her own magazine, called Zoe Anderson Norris. And I realized that the magazine is about the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Mm. It starts to dawn on me that she was documenting the lives of people on the Lower East Side who included my own ancestors, my mother's parents, and my mother's aunts and uncles. And they were newly arrived Ukrainian Jewish immigrants. And Zoe Anderson Norris, which is obviously not a Jewish name, was sympathetically portraying my ancestors in a time of vicious bigotry against them. And I thought, Zoe Anderson Norris, her own magazine. What a nervy woman. Who is this woman? Is anything written about her? And I look on Wikipedia, there isn't even the most basic entry about her. That's how the rabbit hole began.
All right. And what years were her magazine published?
So she lived from 1860 to 1914. The magazine came out every other month from 1909 until she mailed out the last issue days before her death.
Mm-hmm. But your title is pretty interesting. Explain why you decided to come up with this really kind of provocative title.
She published this magazine, 29 issues. They were sort of a blog. She free associated in her own magazine. She pleaded for government reforms to help the poor. She wrote about the partying antics of her friends, members of a group that she called the Ragged Edge Club with a K. So, in the last issue of the East Side magazine, she free associated at the beginning about her recent dream that she was going to die soon. She had dreamed that her long dead mother had come to her bedside on the Lower East Side and said, "You're the next of my children to die." She writes about this vivid dream and how, if it comes true, she'll be relieved to go. She's worked so hard to fight for the poor with her pen. She's tired. And this is how she wants her funeral to play out. She publishes that essay. She goes to a Ragged Edge Club dinner. She collapses. She's brought to a hospital across the street from the Lower East Side restaurant where they're partying. And she dies. So she would never have wanted Queen of Bohemia Predicts Own Death to be the title of a book about her, but she would want a book about her published under any title that would sell the most copies.
So, okay, if she was publishing in the early 1900s, clearly there were very few women journalists at that time. Very few, even more, were publishing their own publications. So how did she get into journalism?
So she married badly as a teenager. As her marriage crumbled, she was from Kentucky, she was living in Wichita, Kansas by the time her marriage was crumbling, and she was bored and neglected by an adulterer, and she began to publish a vicious gossip column in the Wichita paper under a pseudonym, and then she began to publish fiction and journalism. She needed to support herself after the divorce, and she needed to support her growing family after the divorce. She took her daughter with her when they fled Wichita for Europe and then New York. So she published countless short stories and countless journalistic accounts for other publications. And over the years, she was stiffed on fees by men, plagiarized, accused of various misdeeds, sexually harassed by the men she was working for. And by 1909, she was absolutely fed up with working for anyone else but herself. Mm. And there was a flood at that time of small magazines with tiny staffs, underfinanced, so erratic that some of them are known in the trade today as sporadicals, not periodicals.
Wow, I never heard that term.
Sporadicals. But hers came out every other month. By 1909, she was fed up with how she was treated by any boss ever. And she decided, you know, I have a couple of male friends who've pulled this off. I'm going to try it. And if it lasts just one issue, it'll be an interesting experiment. By the time she published it, describing poverty that she was seeing around her on the Lower East Side, she herself was falling into poverty. But she was determined, even if this experiment fails, at least I've, you know, attempted to defy the odds.
An interesting thing about her, because in reading your book, you really do a great job in describing her background. So can you describe a little bit about how she moved from a relatively privileged background to being an advocate for the poor?
So she was the 13th of 15 children of Henry and Henrietta Anderson. Her family was very erudite, but they didn't have a lot of money. Her father was an idealist and a theologian, and her family was at the edge of poverty when she was young. Her father died when she was young. Her mother began to homestead unsuccessfully in Kansas by the time she was a teenager in Kentucky. And I believe that that layer of fear of not having enough to eat might have made her sympathize with the poor. I also believe that that level of fear made her marry young to a relatively prosperous shop owner. She wanted a safety net of some kind. So they moved to Wichita, as I said, and their marriage crumbles, and she was scraping by. But she was seeing how the poor, many of them were incredibly resourceful. She witnessed the poor in New York able to turn a doorway, a stairwell, into a thriving pickle stand, for example. And she marveled at their ability. She also was appalled at how they were described by other journalists and what she was actually witnessing on the streets. The bigotry against immigrants that is quoted today, it is the same lines that she was seeing in print and hearing spouted in speeches. It's the exact same terrible language.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the poor, was she interested in the poor, both black and white?
She was interested in who lived around her on the Lower East Side. It was mostly Italian immigrants and Eastern European Jews. The Great Migration hadn't really come to New York at that time. There were a handful of black people that she knew. The piano player, for example, for her Ragged Edge Club named Harry Huggs, a composer in addition to a skilled ragtime pianist. In the South, she wrote vividly about violence against black people. She wrote, for example, a horrifying story about a black boy who's blamed for a white girl's disappearance and lynched, and then the white girl reappears. She wrote very sympathetically about black people. She also wrote a wonderful story about black cakewalkers competing in a cakewalking contest, and it was illustrated with these, with their great skirts flaring. It's one of the gazillions of syndicated short stories that she published in newspapers.
Wow. All right. So, how did your research journey take shape?
So, in my head, when I start these projects, I have what looks like an old-fashioned semicircular elevator gauge, you know, with the arrow that's pointing from the first to the, for example, 15th floor of an Art Deco skyscraper,
right,
for example. Right. So in my head, I have this gauge. And I know when I'm done, when the gauge gets towards the top floor. So in between doing a million other things, including being a wife and a mom and a daughter and a sister and a pro bono volunteer, I dig sporadically. I began to create a chronological CV for her, which was, you know, 4 pages and then 8 pages. And now it's something like 355 pages. Mm. So scattershottedly, I dig into what short stories she published on newspapers.com. Scattershottedly, I dig into ancestry.com. Mm. And now I'm going to confess something that's just between you and me, Sonia, which is that on March 15th of 2020, when everything shut down, New York Public Library made all of its elite scholarly databases publicly accessible to anyone with a library card at home. Hmm. So I logged into Ancestry Library Edition, and I've never logged out. I've never, when the machine that I've been working on died, it was dying. I brought it to Mike's Tech Shop, bless them, and they simply uploaded everything on my dying machine onto a new machine, including the login to Ancestry Library Edition. So thank you, New York Public Library. So scattershottedly digging into her past, scattershottedly digging into her full resume of fiction and journalism, and I also found her descendants.
I was going to ask you that. Are there any surviving relatives?
So she had 14 siblings, 10 of whom lived to adulthood, many of them married. There are gazillions of her relatives out there. One of them lived 10 blocks from me. Mm. Hello, Linda Rue Allen. One of them lives in Chelsea. Hello, Bridget Goodbody. And there's one box of papers. Hello, Ann Stack and Patty Pellizzari. There's one box of family papers. And the family has been incredibly kind to me about sharing what they have. She predicts her own death. She dies suddenly in 1914. She has a daughter who brings back her possessions to Zoe's hometown in Kentucky. Hello, Harrodsburg. But there's only a handful of her letters and a handful of her typescripts for her short stories.
And there's no transcript, there's no official archive of her papers?
So it's one box, and there's a handful of her correspondence that turns up in institutional collections. So to any young historian or budding historian of any age listening to this, you just never know. You should ask the special collections person at every single institution that owns the papers of anyone who even peripherally knew your biographical subject. She had a tangential friend, a poet named Edwin Markham, and his papers survive on Staten Island, and there's a tiny chance that, you know, and often there's the finding aid. Often these papers were processed 10 years ago, and it's a really vague finding aid. It always pays to email the librarian, because there's an incredibly crucial letter by her that happens to be in the Edwin Markham collection. You just never know which friend of your biographical subject was a pack rat. Definitely email. It never hurts.
That is true. It's interesting, too, about her name. It's pronounced Zoe, but it's spelled, you would look at it and say Zoe. Is that something that she did or the family referred to her as? I just thought it was an interesting kind of thing.
So she published and wrote her name with accents, umlauts, but the family pronounces it Zoe. And I wouldn't know that except that her descendants have been so nice to me.
Right. So you're following the rabbit holes as many places as you can. And when did you decide that you're ready to start writing the manuscript?
So somewhere around the 300th page of the CV, it becomes clear to me that this has to be a book. Mm. And so in spring of 2020, Bio, bless them, formed a bunch of these Zoom support groups. And I was blissfully assigned to one of them. And all of us were getting close to publication or trying to figure out what to do. Most of us had a book contract already.
Did you have one?
And I did not.
Okay.
No, but I was getting there, and I was so determined. And through all sorts of wonderful bio connections, including people who helped me edit my proposal. Shout out to Kathy Curtis. People who shored me up when I was sobbing. Shout out to Carla Kaplan, Allison Gilbert, Sarah Catterall, Amy Reading, et cetera, et cetera. Anyone I'm forgetting, please forgive me. We talked every month. It must have been 2 years, pretty much. And encouraging each other on, and all of us with similar problems or unrelated problems, but advice. You know, what do you do with the relatives who are getting in your way, getting on your nerves? What do you do with the gaps? What do you do with the unsavory parts? What do you do with persuading a publisher to market your work? Mm-hmm. So I was about to give up hope after having sent my proposal to a couple of academic presses, and I literally think I had just sent Carla Kaplan an email saying, I'm going to self-publish this. I just can't do this. No, everyone's turning me down. And then bless them, Fordham University Press, shout out to Fred Knockbauer, agreed to take me on. They have a line called the Empire State Editions that Fred founded, and they've been absolutely awesome.
Great. And she lived in New York how long?
She moved to New York around 1901. And made a couple of trips out of town after that. But basically, she loved Manhattan. She loved the rivers of humanity carving stream beds between the boulders of skyscrapers and the windows of the skyscrapers flashing back the fire of the sun. She said, why would anyone live anywhere else?
So 13 years. So, okay, so now she's in the big city, and you talk about gaps and how you deal with gaps and even scandals. I'm not saying that she was scandalous, but how did you deal with the gaps in the information and any unsavory information about her life?
So the gaps are caused by her distorting her own story. She lied about her age. She shaved ever more years off of her age.
Why?
It was a time when youth was prized as a marital asset. And the journalists of the time, when male journalists and female journalists of her time wrote about women, successful women, they inevitably described whether they were pretty or not. Mm. Belle de Costa Green, the great librarian for the founding director of the Morgan Library. You can't imagine how often when people wrote about her enormous intellectual accomplishments, they had to put in that she was a pretty girl. Zoe was called a girl when she was in her 40s and a grandmother. So the gaps. She claimed this fascinating British pedigree, which isn't true at all. She descended from 17th century English settlers in Virginia. She invented an entire pedigree that doesn't hold water at all. So I had to investigate the truth about that. And she told the truth in her fiction, but in her journalism, she completely tried to befog the story. And she was imperfect. She described ethnicities with terms that are no longer acceptable, and yet she sympathized with all of them at the same time. And I try to convey that she was as contradictory as anyone you know and love.
Mm-hmm. And then once you found the publisher, what was your process from, say, the publisher saying, yes, we accept your proposal, to actually getting the manuscript completed?
So wake up before your family does, or before your loved ones, cohabitants do. Wake up at like 5 a.m. is my recommendation. Down your coffee, skim the headlines, maybe don't play the word games until later in the day. So start as early as you can and get a blur of thoughts down that you think are terrible. I've heard biographers say, I write one or two sentences a day and then I erase them because I'm in agony. Don't be in agony. Write what appears to be junk and stop after 4 hours or so, four and a half maybe, because after that it's diminishing returns. In my case, I can keep going after 4 hours, but it won't be good. And it's as if you're taking a field when you're absolutely exhausted and chopping it up and saying, oh, you know, this is going to be good enough. If you keep going after your prime time, you're going to make more work for yourself the next day going back over it. So I would get up really early and I would plow. And I did this chronologically, plowing and plowing every day. And
every day?
Yeah, every day.
7 days a week?
Pretty much. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 Unless my family, bless them, shout out to Brad and Alina Coleman, wanted me to do something else, I would take a break. It's 6-7 days a week, yeah, on vacation, wherever. Yeah. And then the rest of the day is whatever else you need to do. But don't try to do actual publishable writing after 3-4 hours.
Okay. Eve, I noticed that one of the narrative devices that you use is you'll describe something about Zoe or her publication or her life, and then you'll ask questions that a reader might ask. What made you decide to use that narrative approach?
I decided to never say, it is probable that, or she must have, because those annoy me. And I'm also going to quote Stacey Schiff, because Stacey Schiff said eventually she discovered in the course of her gazillions of best-selling books that readers like questions. They much prefer questions to putting words in people's mouths. I decided to help the reader follow me on my journey and indicate where the gaps are.
Perfect. Did you work with an editor?
I handed in my manuscript to Fred. It was sent out for peer review. And Jennifer Puzzi, shout out to you. One of my peer reviewers wanted to be identified, and she wrote, you know, great, great book, great manuscript, but here's 40 things I would urge the author to look into further. Something like that. Thank you, Jennifer. You're an angel. She gave me suggestions line by line by line. And I said, oh, right, you know, she's right. This isn't really clear, and this could, I'm possibly distorting the perspective here. So Zoe Anderson Norris went to Europe with her daughter, Clarence. And her daughter, as a teenager, met and disastrously married a handsome, adulterous Brit. Their marriage was falling apart when her daughter, Clarence, was pregnant. And they're in England, and Zoe whisks her pregnant daughter back to the States, back to safety. The daughter eventually goes back to this terrible man, but that's a story for another podcast. So Clarence was 7 months pregnant on the ocean liner coming back from London to the States. And I simply quoted a family memoir. Clarence's daughter, Mary, tried to publish a biography of Zoe that was never completed and never published. And in that book manuscript, it says, you know, Zoe distracted the steamship staff from realizing that Clarence was pregnant. I just put that in. I thought, this is just evidence of Zoe's nerviness. And Jennifer said, why would there have been a problem with a married woman, 7 months pregnant, traveling across the ocean? We're not talking a plane flight, mm-hmm. and there's doctors on board. And I said, oh, right. Would that have actually been a problem? And so I ended up finding out that because Clarence was married to a Brit, and she was pregnant, and she was coming to the States, there was a risk that she had lost her citizenship, and that baby would be deemed what we would now call an anchor baby, and that would have been problematic. And she risked being deported at 7 months pregnant.
Even though she was an American.
Yes, a woman marrying an American woman marrying a non-American in the early 1900s risked losing her citizenship and being deemed someone who's come to the States to have the state support her and her newborn.
That's crazy.
And yet, not that much has changed.
No, unfortunately. No. All right, so then if you were sitting in front of either potential biographers or someone who's in the midst of starting their journey, what would you recommend that they do?
There's no such thing as no. There's just not here and not yet. I've met so many people through bio who are at the early stages. You know, they've inherited an apartment full of documentation of a pioneering Black athlete and they don't know what to do with it. Or they are determined to write about someone that there's no paper trail for. I think Stacey Schiff for Cleopatra had one word. If it interests you, it's going to interest someone else. Don't be discouraged.
And even if you think about your subject about Zoe, how many people know her name or know of her contributions in journalism today?
She isn't mentioned in some of the early books about women journalists. The Queen of Bohemia Predicts Own Death is a version of the hundreds of headlines, hundreds of obituaries appeared with a variant on that headline. She was known around the world in her time. And her daughter Clarence, who inherited her literary estate, there was some man who claimed that he was actually her literary executor, but it's absolutely not true. Her daughter was a country girl living in Kentucky and not, you know, without New York literary connections. Her daughter adored not only her mother, but also her mother's work, but didn't have connections, didn't have clout. History gets written by whether you have a significant other that is absolutely determined. We wouldn't know anything about Vincent van Gogh except that Theo's widow happened to be absolutely determined to make sure that his paper survived and that his paintings were drawing the proper acclaim.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add about Zoe and her contributions?
Join bio. You can't imagine how supported I feel. And we all have similar struggles.
Exactly.
And there's problems that I can sympathize with other biographers that I don't have, which is that someone else wrote a biography badly about their subject X decades ago, and there's all kinds of legends that they have to combat.
You don't have that problem.
I don't have that problem.
at all. You are blazing the trail here.
Thank you, Sonia. I'm trying. Yes.
Well, good luck on the book, and thank you so much for coming to speak with us today.
You're an awesome interviewer. I got to finish my coffee now.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was author Eve Kahn speaking with me about her latest book, Queen of Bohemia Predicts Own Death, Gilded Age Journalist Zoe Anderson Norris. It was published by Fordham University Press this September, and this interview was recorded on June 6th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., during BIO's annual conference. To learn more about BIO or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a great day.